Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Please find a seat. For those of you standing up in the back, there are plenty of seats down here in the front. You may not be able to escape as quickly if you would like, but there are plenty of seats down here, so please come and take advantage of them. Good afternoon. It is April 10th. It is 3 o'clock p.m., and this is program number 2503 for those of you listening at home. This is Home Sweet Hostel, How to Make Travel a Lifestyle, and the focus is a student-oriented discussion on how to prioritize travel, how to afford it, how to weigh stability versus exploration, and incorporate travel into a career. And you could not have three more qualified panelists to address these issues and talk to you about those topics today. They are a formidable group of people who have carved out lives with significant travel connections, doing such things as philanthropic work, ski racing, presenting around the world on economic development. It is truly a fascinating group of people. We have on the far left Connor Line. Yep. I'm hoping I'm getting these right. April Rinney and Keith Sproul. And by process of decision beforehand, Connor's going to start out and tell you a little bit about sort of his background, his connections to travel, his connections to the world, and then we'll start talking about a few other things. But without further ado, thank you, Connor.
All right. So, yeah, thank you for being here, and it's a pleasure to be a part of this conference. It's my first ever actual conference, so I might be a little nervous, speaking to a crowd, but it should be fun. So my travel experience, I'm Irish originally, and I moved to the U.S. when I was very young. Moved to Logan, Utah, of all places in the world. My parents had never been there before, so that was an interesting experience growing up there, and that's how I got into ski racing. My parents had never skied before. They just kind of put us on the slopes when we were younger, and we eventually graduated up into representing Ireland internationally on the circuit. So we kind of progressed through that, and I eventually competed for Ireland in the 2014 Olympic Games in Russia. And through that, met people from all over the world, different backgrounds, different sporting backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, and that's kind of shaped the way that I see travel today and how I kind of have launched a career and other passions into that space. So I'll probably take you back to, I was in a camp basically before the Olympic Games where I was in, it was 15 of us guys, 15 girls, and we were part of the developing nations of winter sport, which Ireland was one of them. We don't have mountains, obviously. And we basically went through pain and suffering and of the training camps that is required to become an Olympic athlete. And through that, I developed a really special bond with these men and women that has still to this day been probably one of my most treasured relationships. People from Georgia, people from the Balkan states, people from the Baltic states, as well as South Africa and Central and South America, people that you would never really assume would be on a mountain side by side with you training, vying for a Winter Olympic Games. And so through that, after the Olympic Games was over, I kind of felt at loss of what I wanted to do with myself. I was back in Utah, I was back at the university, and I didn't really know what I wanted to throw my passion into next. And, through the experience of staying and living with these, incredibly different and diverse people, I wanted to focus on travel, I wanted to focus on photography. And that was through a random college class for my fine arts credit, as probably some people in the audience here might be fulfilling as well. And I just really threw all of my hard work and dedication that I had learned through the Olympic experience and put it into photography. So I went out to Jordan, which is kind of my first time in the Middle East, and I met this young family in Wadi Rum. For those of you who don't know where that is, it's a large desert area in southern Jordan that is probably most infamous in Lawrence of Arabia, one of the great films of our time. And I was speaking to them about, dreams and kind of the hardships they were facing, especially at this crucial time in the Middle East, and how this man's kids dreamed of going to America and Europe and just the West and becoming, university students or doctors or nurses. And I kind of took a photo of this young gentleman, and it just kind of really turned out to be a great photo that I was surprised myself. I was quite lucky. And I eventually just thought, okay, well, why don't I explore the world and travel and ask people what their dreams are? So I was fortunate enough, obviously, to grow up in America, have the privilege of, you know, and the financial backing of my parents to explore ski racing. And that dream was important to me, but, you know, there's several other people throughout the world that have dreams. They may be more simple, they may be less elaborate than the Olympics, but still important, and I wanted to demonstrate that. So throughout my senior year of college, I sacrificed my entire social life for, you know, senior year is the time where you're supposed to party and let loose and not really care about grades and everything else. But I ditched all that and I started driving for Uber. I was working, you know, valet shifts at the hotels downtown. And I guess from a Olympics experience to driving for Uber, it doesn't feel that great all of a sudden. But again, I still put that passion into, you know, I focused on a goal, and I focused on I wanted to travel, you know, after I graduated. And I really just honestly hustled my way into exploring the world. And those 4 months after graduation, I traveled to 21 different countries and met, you know, people in Iran, Iraq, Southern Africa, such as Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, and then through Central America, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Cuba, for example. And I, you know, founded basically this photography project that envisioned exploring dreams and reducing stereotypes of people around the world. And that's something I'm still very passionate about today. I'm actually moving to Japan on Monday. It was quite, yeah, random, a tight schedule. And I'll be able to kind of take that project into Eastern Asia, which is a region I haven't really explored too well at the moment. So that's just a little bit about my background anyway, of how I kind of got to this panel, I guess. But I'll let some of the most experienced people take over from here.
So thank you, Connor, and thank you all for being here. Full disclosure, I'm on 8 panels this week. This is the one I'm most excited about. So welcome, happy you're here, and this is my third CWA. It's become one of my favorite weeks.
Oh, oops, sorry.
That was, no worries. And drop the mic. The mic drop moment already. Yeah. So a bit about me. We agreed that we would begin with our stories, and then we'll get into some of the, you know, the how-tos and the nuts and bolts, but so that you will understand how we got to today. So I'm going to take you back a little bit, and I apologize. I'm going to make this brief, but it's a story I'm really proud of. It's a story that I didn't start sharing until recently, but particularly for the students in the group, I hope that it resonates on a few different levels. So I come from a family of teachers. My dad was a geographer, grew up with a love of maps and the world and diversity, and every morning over breakfast, we would play the capital game. So you know how kids have, like, a plastic placemat with a cat or a ball? Mine had a map of the world. And we didn't have a lot growing up. It was never about physical possessions. But every morning over breakfast, my dad and I would play the capital game. And he'd name a country, and I'd, over time, learn the capitals. And names like Addis Ababa, Ulaanbaatar, Ouagadougou. Who does not want to go to Ouagadougou, right? These words were magical. And I just grew up with a sense that the world was a small place. Didn't have the resources to travel much other than for my dad's studying, which was mostly my dad's research, which was mostly in U.S. national parks. But there were two things that were drilled into my mind as early as I can remember. One, the world is an amazing place. Diversity is our strength. And there was nothing cooler that I could do than figure out a way to go explore it. Two, the fact that I was a girl and got to go to school, elementary school, made me one of the luckiest kids on the planet. And because I was a girl and had been so lucky to get an education, I had a duty to give back, a responsibility. And most of all, what that meant for my parents was that my career, whatever that ended up being, could not be about me. It had to be of service in some way. And my parents never told me what I had to do. They said, you can serve in many ways. You can teach, you can be a doctor, you can be an environmentalist, But whatever you do, never forget how lucky you've been just to get an education and have a roof over your head. And, again, map of the world every day. And I had this book, Children of Many Lands. It was the first picture book I remember with these kids, just photos, but kids from all over the place. And I still have this book. It's one of, I kept two of my dad's books, this book and his atlas. So that's the context with which I grew up. But again, very modest. My parents were like, we're not paying for any of this, but if you can find a way to do this, we will never get in your way, and we will cheer you on. So I grew up with this love of international, global development, other places. This is just interesting. Then I am in college, and I had figured out how to, I was studying international studies, surprise, surprise, econ and poli-sci and a touch of history and a little bit of art history on the side. And I had managed to earn a scholarship to study abroad because my parents weren't going to pay for that during my junior year. And so I was in Europe, and I got a phone call, and it was my sister. And she said, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, both of my parents died in a car accident my junior year in college. Okay, not what one expects, but all of a sudden, overnight, my life shifted, not just in terms of personally and how I'm going to figure out how to move forward, but also, what was the legacy that I wanted to have in the world? What would make, not that I felt guilt from my parents or anything like that, but how could I live my life in a way that would make them proud? And I knew it wasn't about climbing a corporate ladder. I knew it wasn't about making a lot of money. I knew it was about something that would make them really excited if they were still alive that we might have done together, and that I could make sense of and was of service to the world. So that's, you know, I'm 20. Like, okay, now what? Take a semester off of college to really, we had to deal with, you know, I won't get into the details, but I did go to law school, and the reason I ended up going to law school is because I found myself in the legal system dealing with the accident of my parents. And there is a lawyer here, and this all happened in Colorado. There is a lawyer here who, for whom I am eternally grateful. Actually, my host for CWA. So, moving on, I graduate. And the one thing society and my relatives and everybody's saying, with your credentials, you need to go to Wall Street. You need to get a job. You need to, like, go. And I was like, this goes beyond the scope of this panel, but at the time, I had a very clear sense that I didn't have long to live either. Irrational, but I really believed that I did not have long to make this impact that I wanted. And so, all of that just, nope, don't think so. The death of my parents led me to make a very different set of decisions, personally and professionally, about my path. And I always want to say, it doesn't require tragedy to do this. For any student here, it's a lot more fun without it. All it takes is a mindset shift. I truly believe that I didn't have that long to live, so what was I going to do? I said, well, the one thing I know full stop I want to do more of is travel, but I got to find a way to do it. So I will paraphrase here. I spent the 4 years in between college and grad school with no permanent address, a backpack, a budget about yay big, we'll get to that in a minute, and a sole goal of seeing how as much of the rest of the world lived as I could so that I could figure out how I could be best of service. And I had made a pact with my parents I would go to grad school. I knew that was in the cards. I just didn't know what. That ended up being one of the most interesting, it was a phenomenal chapter in my book of life. I learned that traveling overseas costs less than the average burn rate here in the U.S., if anyone tells you that it costs a lot of money. I ended up researching and guiding hiking and biking trips. I was mentioning this, and I did this. I worked 6 months a year. I researched and guided hiking and biking trips in Italy, and then they ended up sending me to Patagonia and Vietnam and so forth, which wasn't enough money to pay a mortgage or raise a family, but it was plenty to travel the rest of the 6 months. And so I did that. And I figured out how it was going to be of impact and what I was going to do, and it was still around global development. And I ended up going and doing my law degree and my finance degree focused on international economic development. And I can tell you more about what I do now. It has led to chapter after chapter where I've worked. I spent more than a decade in focus exclusively on emerging markets, looking at things like microfinance and sustainable business development at the base of the economic pyramid. More recently, I'm sort of part of this new economy, looking at how business models that are built through your smartphone are transforming the world, including travel and tourism, but also mobility, public health, you name it. I advise governments and startups around the world, and for the last 6 years, this didn't happen overnight, but for the last 6 years, I've finally built enough credibility. I'm independent. I don't have a boss. I don't have any direct reports. And I consult and advise companies and governments around the world. I have a home in the U.S., but I work in about 20 different countries a year. And I don't have anyone telling me whether I can or cannot do it. And I don't have any, how do I say this? What I learned in my 20s about what is enough and what it takes to lead a meaningful life and realizing it's not actually about the physical possessions and it doesn't have to cost a lot of money, has paid off in droves later in life. And sometimes the way I characterize it is I think I had a midlife crisis when I was 20. I was asking those questions that a lot of my peers seem to be asking now. And for those of you who are earlier in your life, the sooner you can ask those things, what I love is that there are so many more ways to craft a unique work-life balance, professional path. I mean, there are tools out there all around you to live, work, and travel differently, including global digital remote work, global and digital nomads, remote work, including, I have a friend who actually, she talks about her work in seasons. In the spring, she does this there. In the fall, she does this somewhere else. And she lives in 4 countries per year. This is fascinating. This wasn't possible 20 years ago. And for those of you who are just starting out, like, the next 20 years are going to be, I think, even more transformational in this regard than the last 20. So I want to dive into all of that. Thank you.
In thinking how we could start with a few moments of background, the intent of speaking to students, I look out at the audience and I just realize that travel, we're all citizens of the world, youth of the world, students of the world, we're a young crowd. Talking to a Boulder audience about travel is almost as bad as talking to Boulder folks about yoga or mountain biking. So there's a lot of experience in the room, let's acknowledge that, and I'm sure there's people that are passionate about this field. If I could say something to the students that might inspire, I feel very fortunate that I can say since the start of the year, I have been to Siem Reap district in Cambodia, where on behalf of the company that I work for, we opened 2 new primary schools that we built from scratch. I've been in Iceland and have had meetings with a whale museum talking about the impact of plastics in the ocean, and we're going to fund a new presentation at that whale museum about the impact of plastics and what travelers can do and what the shipping industry needs to do. And I just had my daughter in Belize when we climbed Victoria Peak and spent, the highlight was 3 nights, you know, in a hammock between trees in the rainforest. And that's a typical 3-month pattern for the way that my life, my work has evolved. And I share that, and it sounds like that obnoxious guy at the end of the bar. I don't mean that. It's we've given ourselves permission to try to inspire. So please excuse if it sounds obnoxious. I wouldn't usually share that. How did it begin? At 18, I had parents who were very supportive. It sounds like you guys did too, and I sure hope that that's the case for many of you. I kind of felt like college wasn't what I needed to do at 18. I needed to walk about. And they said, go forth. And for the older crowd in the room, you might remember People's Express, People's Distress, as we used to call it, $150 ticket to London. I bought a one-way and got off and didn't have a plan. And in those days, we actually carried the guidebooks, the big heavy ones. And as you moved, you know, you took a scissor and you cut out the pages where you'd been. Yeah, see, only half the audience laughs, right? For the rest of you, it's an app these days. And that was Europe, and hitchhiking around Europe at 18. Hitchhiking, that's a word we don't use. I hitchhiked through Morocco at 18, went across to Tunisia. And that wanderlust was somewhere deep inside, and I had the support of parents. Graduated and almost did the same, you know, anyway, through university, studied environmental sciences, loved that, loved applying it to global topics, countries, international topics. At the end of college, got on a plane, went to Japan without a job, without anything lined up, but ended up working at Toyota teaching English, and loved Japan. The revolution, 1990, I'm dating myself, changes in Central Europe. Václavské náměstí, the former Czechoslovakia. The Czechs all showed up in mass, and there were changes in November of 89. In January of 90, I arrived and was teaching at the Agricultural University of Prague. These are not life paths, decisions that you can actually plan. And I think that's my biggest message, is that the greatest barrier for youth when I'm speaking to folks that are expressing an interest is, as we've shared earlier in the conversation tonight, that the barrier is yourself. And for whatever reason, I always believed, I'm just going to show up and it's going to happen and we'll make it happen. And I taught for a year at the Agricultural University, Vysoka Škola Zemědělská in Praha Sedm in Czech Republic in 1990. It was awesome. When you can go to the bar and buy everybody in the house a beer for 10 cents a pop before they got the exchange rate correct, life proceeds. I came back. I ended up going to graduate school. I studied international economics, Fulbright, doing economic research around protected areas in Central America, led to work with the World Bank. It led to a career now that has included some of the international conservation organizations and a very unique spot working for a private sector luxury travel company who has a commitment to giving back. And so I have the privilege, the joy of waking up each day and thinking about how best to make a difference in the lives and livelihoods of the communities where our guests travel in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And we're building schools like we did in Siem Reap. We're building maternity wards in communities that are suffering the plague of HIV transmission from mother to child. We're supporting conservation initiatives, including the translocation of rhino. And we're building crazy things like bike shops and giving women the opportunity to sell old mountain bikes from the States that transform a life by continuing to provide alternative transport. Again, I want to qualify that we all sort of looked at each other and said, if we sit up here and it sounds like we're bragging, is that going to be a good way to start? It was for the students mostly. Thank you.
I told you it was a formidable group. And I forgot to read this at the beginning, but it's all printed out. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand, in the old-fashioned way, to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. You must write legibly. If you are a student or attending remotely, please note this in your question. And particularly if you are a student, note that ideally at the top of the question, because that is in a lot of ways the focus of today's session. And then it says make your questions brief and to the point. One of the things, I think particularly with a student-focused audience like this, and we talked about this a little bit before, these are the type of excuses or reasons that I have always heard why I can't just pick up and get on a plane to London one way without a plan, or show up in Japan without a job, or do any of those sort of things. I don't have the time. I'm too busy. I've got a career. Are you kidding? It would be suicide for my job and my profession. I can't afford it. I don't have any money. I don't want to travel alone. It might be dangerous. What am I going to say to my parents, my friends, my boyfriend, my girlfriend? Everything will be in chaos. I think particularly for the students, demystifying those myths and those untruths, the poppycock of all of that would be terrifically helpful. And April, when we start with you, can you share some sensibilities about why discounting those excuses is so important, if you're not just to make a career out of travel, but just to get out of the country and see some of the world, which is so critical?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll also add one to the mix. I'm female, which I don't want to discount is an issue. And walking out of your house in the United States tends to be one of the more dangerous activities today. So happy to. So where do I want to start with this? I mean, I kind of come back to that. For me, and again, it's really, I'm very aware, hyper aware, I think, of the fact of how what I went through with my parents, it was a huge nudge. And all of a sudden it was like, whoa. No parental sounding board. There's no one to tell me I can't go do this. At the same time, I knew they would be really proud. But I continue, and even today, I go back to this whole thing about, all right, it's all about, I don't want to sound morbid, but like what would you put on your epitaph if you were to die tomorrow? Would you have lived the life that you want? But also just candidly regrets. And we all have regrets in life to some degree. I mean, it's part of the human condition. But that sense of, will I regret doing something? Maybe. Maybe you end up getting held up at gunpoint in Bolivia like I did. That was exciting. Maybe you end up on a, not known to me at the time, drug boat going down the Mekong River between Cambodia and Laos. Didn't know it was packed with drugs until we landed. Okay, sure. That happened. And I had my travel wits about me, and we can talk about that, you know, on another question. But will I regret doing something, or will I regret not trying? And it's the not trying piece that I think gets people really hung up. And so in my case, and it's not just about me. I often, and I can't remember if I said this in my intro, runs, so anything, I can't afford it. I am on my own, self-sufficient at 20. In fairness, I don't think I have long to live, so I'm not worried about a big nest egg. But I'm not going to go into debt traveling, right? Run some numbers, especially anyone who's young, before you have a lot of obligations, before you have, you know, I don't want to say roots, but, you know, life is expensive here. Now is the time to do it. And that's not to say that you may have student loans to pay, et cetera, et cetera. I ran the numbers, and in fairness, I admire people who are like, I got on a plane and I had no idea. I had a plan. I had a plan because I knew I didn't have a backstop. And I have extended family who supports me, or who, you know, encourage me. But I didn't have my childhood home. I didn't have a place to hang my hat. So I did my homework, and I ran the numbers, and I was like, wow, this actually looks pretty good. And I knew what I needed to earn, and I knew how much it cost. And in my case, at that time, work, the hiking and biking, that would pay for me to get to a country. That's the expensive part. The plane ticket is what's expensive. So anybody, I also like to say, anybody who has frequent flyer miles out there, would you please gift them to a younger person? I'm not joking. That is the most expensive thing. That is what I have a lot of miles at this point, and I make a routine of gifting those to others because that can go a long way when you're somebody young, and that's the most expensive line item in your budget. Once you get to a lot of these countries, and my whole thing was, how do I see how the rest of the world lives? So I was not, you know, over the course of my life, I've you know, traveled in the most expensive places and some of the least expensive. But at that time, I was really interested in global development. There's not a single country out there that is particularly expensive to live in once you get there. And I'm fast-forwarding a little bit now, but one other thing that has happened since then, particularly as we look at remote work, global, digital nomads, that sort of thing, the longer you stay in one place, the cheaper it is to live there. When you're on transit every day, that can add up, whether it's buses or planes or whatever. Also, from an environmental footprint, and I struggle with this continually, that flight negates any, unless you're doing carbon credits or an airline that partners and is developing low emissions fuel, that airplane negates no amount of recycling you can do in hotels and B&Bs and whatever. So when you're staying in one place longer, actually integrating with the community, being able to work, being able to live, your costs just go down a lot. And there's so much I want to talk about here, but I want to try to keep this, it's not brief, but anyone who's interested, there are all kinds of resources out there now, tools to help you get started, whether it's planning your trip, whether it's, if you are a sort of digital nomad, where to go, where the best co-working spaces are, how to find other people, how to find jobs. I was mentioning to these two gentlemen earlier that a company that I advise now, it's in Estonia, it's a startup, it's called Jabatical. What do you think that is? Job plus sabbatical. They arrange, they match people who want to live and work overseas for up to a year, maybe two, with startups typically in emerging markets who can't find that talent locally. Who do they hire? People, the number of people who are now professionals, they have some skills. They always wanted to live or work abroad. They have every excuse in the book, can't afford it. But also, my idea these days of going, I've always dreamed of visiting Thailand. But my idea of a good time in Thailand isn't spending 3 months on the beach or 3 months on a boat or, you know, different city every day. I want to contribute to the local economy. So looking at some of what Keith was saying, and how do you contribute locally, but not with your money, not with charity, with your time and talent and whole being. That's now far more possible, and Jabbatical is one of dozens of platforms out there that can help you get started in that regard. I'll pause there.
Sure. Have at it, Connor.
All right. So I agree with everything that April just said, by the way. I'll push back a little bit on the neat plan. I fly by the seat of my pants. I book a flight months, years in advance, and I just book it, and then it's confirmed. It's cheap. If you book a flight a year in advance, it's going to be very, very cheap. And then I kind of plan from there. And then I look, okay, I booked this flight. Now I can start doing a little bit of budgeting and like, how much money do I need to make this trip happen? And I think that the biggest excuse that I hear from my friends during college and everything else is money. How do I afford? I've got student loans, or maybe if they even have a scholarship, it's like, well, I'm just paying to live here in college and everything else. How can I afford to travel? And honestly, the answer is, it's not a nice one. It's just, you just have to work harder, to be honest. You just have to hustle. You have to get a night shift job. You have to drive for Uber. You have to sell a lot of your belongings that might be not as valuable to you anymore, but you're kind of still holding on to them because you think they'll be useful later, like an Xbox or a TV or something like that. I'm sure everyone in this room could sell something and easily go on a trip tomorrow if they just kind of let it go, simplified their life. I think that's the one thing that I've learned throughout the course of my very young career compared to these two here, is that you can just really simplify the way you travel. When I was going to these 21 countries over 4 months, I booked 27 flights in advance. 27 different legs, and it all came to $3,000, right? So you could book, you could find a European ticket probably from here that might even be close to $3,000 round trip. And so you have to go on the budget airlines. You'll have to go on the Ryanairs of Africa and the Ryanairs of Asia and Middle East. And they might not have great airline safety ratings, but... But the likelihood of that happening is very, very minimal. I definitely wanted to comment on, it's dangerous, especially from a solo perspective or from a female perspective. And again, like, I'm not a woman, obviously, but it is a real thing, but I feel like the danger in the world is completely exaggerated by the Western media that we have today. I went to Iran, a country now that is in frontline news, given our current administration, that it is radical, it's full of terrorists, etc., etc. I went there not knowing anyone. I didn't pay for a single thing when I was there. I was taken in by people off the streets. I was fed during Ramadan, which they weren't really supposed to do at the time. And the hospitality of people throughout the world will blow your mind. And I think it's just something that you have to really take that leap of faith and experience firsthand. You're not honestly going to listen to someone like me and be like, oh, well, just because Connor says it, now you're going to go out and do it. You really just have to take that leap of faith and go forward. And I would say, in terms of, say, from the female perspective, one of the bravest travelers I ever met was, I met this woman from Australia. She was about 4'8", blonde. She stuck out like a sore thumb in the Middle East. And she had backpacked and hitchhiked, not even planes, nothing, from southern India through Pakistan, Iran, Iraq. I met her in Iraq. And then she was literally holding out a sign in Arabic, take me to the Turkish border, which at the time, 2016, was filled with ISIS-held areas, rebel Kurdish groups, etc. And she just went for it. She's fine now. She's happily back in Australia. So you just have to take that risk. And I think that's one of the hardest things for a young person to do in any facet of their life. So you just have to take that leap of faith. And you have to really believe in yourself that you're capable to do it.
Can I pick up just briefly on the female piece? So I did want to mention this. And also this bigger picture, observation, I guess, where you have a very good demographic up here, I think, because so I did those 4 years, and since then I've continued. I was telling, I work in about 20 different countries a year now, but I have a home base, and it's in Portland, Oregon, so not too far away. I did those 4 years of traveling when, so I'm going to date myself as well. I had email in college. I did not have email in high school. I remember, I am of a generation that, I think I got email in high school, yeah, but didn't really use it. Had it, but you know, early, like, you're going to do what? You want me to look at what online for my class? When Wikipedia was like, you can't put that in your research paper. It is not a legitimate news source. That sort of thing. So mobile phones existed, but I actively ditched them. I only had a mobile phone because I had to have one for the biking trips, but when I wasn't getting a trip, I'd put it away. So we had the internet. We had travel blogs. They were so early, but I bring this up because I traveled in a time when, yes, I could have a travel blog and I could send out, you know, notes to my friends and family, but I could and often had to drop off the face of the planet for weeks at a time. Technology was not a crutch. There was not. We did not have GPS. I like to say I did a lot of Airbnb kind of travel, but before Airbnb, and I now work with Airbnb, so it's very interesting because I could have, and Airbnb is a, you know, whatever, it's been super helpful to help people connect with unique lodgings. I miss those pre-Airbnb days. I miss when I got off the bus and I'd be like, here I am in, I don't know, remote Romania. I need to find a house. I'm not going to stay in a hotel. I'm going to stay with a like, I know there will be a grandmother here waiting to fetch me. And invariably there was. And this is the other point I want to bring up. So technology is one of those things where, building on what Connor said, the important thing is, I get that, particularly as women, having technology, that is a power tool for you to use while you are traveling, to do your research, to let people know where you are, etc. I also know that if I had traveled with this smartphone at all times, I never would have had 98% of the serendipity that came into my life if I were with a screen. I was actually, and again, I say vulnerable, but with some wits about me. Here's what I had people say again and again. They're like, how could you do, you know, of those 4 years, of the time that I was not guiding, 98% of that time I was solo. And the 2% was when I had random friends in towns that I could stay with. And they were, you're crazy, you're single. And I stuck out like a sore thumb. Small, blonde, whatever. The irony, what they didn't realize, what they thought was a deficit was actually a superpower. So if I were a man, hate to say it, the grandmother would not have said, oh, you clean. I had people, I would be walking down the street and I would have windows thrown open, typically in smaller towns, and would hear this booming, like, lady, are you lost? And I'd be like, I think I'm just going up. You know, who are you? You are clearly lost. What are you doing here alone? And, you know, I'd be like, okay. Long story short, if I were a man, that wouldn't have happened. If I were a female traveling with a man or a woman, would not have happened, because they would have been like, she's okay because she's with this other person. Because I was female and solo, they looked at me like kind of a pity case. But what that meant is I got invited into countless homes. I got escorted countless times to the train station. They bought my ticket. They put me on the train. Bye-bye. You'll be okay. That's actually a pretty cool thing to think about for the young solo independent travelers. I was actually kept very safe, primarily by families and grandmothers. But I want to sort of flip that idea on its head as well. All over. So at this point, I've been, and it's just whatever. Yeah, everywhere. So I've been to 100-ish, 100 and change countries at this point. And Eastern Europe, throughout Latin America, throughout Sub-Saharan Africa, sometimes harder in parts of Africa where, depending on the infrastructure of a city, throughout Asia, Southeast Asia, India. I mean, there isn't a place this doesn't happen, except for typically the U.S.
Keith, part of the sort of where we started there had to do with, you know, well, it will be career suicide. And I'm looking through a lot of the questions here, and you seem so perfectly suited to address this. How do I sort of reading the question, how do you, if you want to go abroad and you want to travel, but you want to somehow turn it into a career, how do you parlay that together? And I think more sort of fundamentally, how is travel ever not going to be good for your career in the future as opposed to some sort of career suicide? You've had a lot of different opportunities there.
You know, so much of what we end up doing is folks who travel a lot is we tell our stories. So you're hearing stories, huh? and that's true, I think, for everyone in the audience. And if you can tell stories, if you've got stories to tell, you're a far more interesting applicant regardless of whatever field you're looking into for career. You're a more interesting person. You've got a global, you know, a larger worldview. So I would certainly encourage that just from, you know, a personal perspective, but a professional perspective, it's a positive. It's a positive to be able to demonstrate in the context of an interview that you have the wherewithal, you have the strength, the character to be able to say, I went forth to X and I did this. And it's going to make you different because there are still so many people who cannot say that. And they need to be able to. We need to be able to. You know what I wanted to do? I wanted to highlight for those students in the room or listening that are at that juncture where, and I get many questions, I want to do something really good, you know? I want to contribute, but I don't want to do the Peace Corps. Get it. The Peace Corps is awesome, and if it's not for you, there are many, many other paths. It used to be that was the primary channel. Peace Corps volunteers today are of every age, and they're not necessarily just college graduates. But if it's not for you, my strongest recommendation is go. But then if you really want to do something in service-oriented, if you show up at the average nonprofit, overseas it's called an NGO, non-government organization, if you show up at the door of an NGO, regardless of sector, conservation sector, education sector, healthcare, social services, and you're from the States, you have something that they're going to need right away. And I tell you what it is, it's so simple. You speak good English, probably. I'm a little concerned about some of the millennial generation. You know, memes are not a way of actually talking. But if you knock on the door with energy and enthusiasm and an interest and say, you know, if there's something that I could possibly contribute, usually small NGOs are struggling. And they're struggling with their grant applications, they're struggling with their reports, communicating with their supporters. And that primary service of helping with English is something that will give you an entree, a door opener. And I can tell you that in the context of the different programs that we support, and I'm not making this as a general offer, please, I'm suggesting it broadly, that, you know, we introduce a lot of youth to NGOs that for whom they can spend 2 or 3 weeks, and they support in a very strategic way with the language. So that's one. But I definitely want to hit hard back on the idea, and Connor, I actually spend a lot of time talking to people, those who fail to plan to fail. I agree with that. However, no one today has an excuse not to travel. And let me tell you how you start. Des Moines, Iowa. I'm telling you, it's the epicenter of transformation, transformative travel, Des Moines. Buy your ticket to Des Moines, and you will, in that process, figure out how to lodge yourself, feed yourself, you know, identify activities that you want to do. You're going to try to do it in more interesting ways. You're going to have access to every single possible travel app in the world because it's all out there today. You can find those cheap flights. You can find the cheap train rides. You can do car delivery services. You can do house sharing. And you can take care of somebody's farm for a week. All these apps are possible. You can find a farmer and date the guy. It's so at your fingertips in a way that wasn't. Now, we revel in the memory of the old guidebooks that we cut up and all the other sort of getting off the bus and not knowing where we're going. But actually, that's never going to come back unless you just choose to ignore the world. Embrace it, and it's all so much more readily possible for you. The last strong suggestion relative to the issue of cost of travel for plane tickets, the credit cards, that game is a real opportunity for the folks who churn miles. And I'll tell you a very funny reaction. I was sitting in an airport with at one of the shared tables having a drink, and this young gal is explaining to her friends, "Let me pay because I'm collecting miles." And so I offered to let her pay for mine, and I paid her cash. I loved that. That's awesome. So there are so many strategies to get there. Please don't ever use the excuse, "I'm just not sure how," because you all know how to use those phones, and you all know how to apply, approach these apps. And the travel industry is exploding with more and increasingly cost-efficient ways to get you there.
One of the things I think just has to be the case as someone who's hired as well. If an employer is not interested in you because you took 9 months and went and traveled, went to Asia, went to Africa.
You don't want to work there.
You don't want to work there. And that is just fundamentally a fact, isn't it? I've got more questions than I could ever possibly read, but here are a couple of quick bullet ones because it's come up a lot. So I'm going to shoot through these really quickly. I'm going to run right down the row. Keith, quick question. What is something that you have taken on your travels that you were most glad that you brought? What's that most critical thing that goes into your small, very, very portable, very, very packable small suitcase?
It's so ridiculous. I carry a mask. And it's like this old man mask, you know, and it's the funnest thing to break out at the most obscene, obnoxious times. Like when you're in the airport for 3 hours because the plane is delayed and you pull that thing out, it just changes the atmosphere of all those sad people. Or you get to that school and it's after hours and the kids are playing football or, soccer, and you go run out in the field with that thing on. It just anyway, I carry a crazy old man mask.
Oh, and before I go down, I forgot, I was asked to announce that all 4:30 panels will be proceeding as scheduled, notwithstanding the bomb cyclone. And so they will all be going on, even though part of the university is closing. April, sorry.
Oh, gosh, that's fabulous. That's really good. And I'm going to take a page from that book, although I'm joking. I totally know the people who would cut out the pages. I couldn't bring myself to do that, and I use Lonely Planets, and so I would haul these things everywhere. But I now have two bookcases of Lonely Planets that are like these relics, but I won't get rid of them. But you saved yourself a lot of weight. So for me, in a similar vein, I could say, medication, malaria medication, like don't leave home without that. But in my case, I'm going to focus on the icebreaker. So this is not so much a thing as a skill. You remember that guy who was chicken dance guy? Like goes everywhere and does a photo with a chicken, or people that would carry a teddy bear? And, photograph the teddy bear. Well, I happen to have grown up doing gymnastics. Turns out I can walk on my hands. And I had family, and again, this is in the immediate aftermath, my extended family, people who became my family, who were really worried about me as I was traveling, but they weren't my parents. They knew that I did handstands. They'd seen me do handstands, and they said, "You know what? You should do handstands wherever you travel. Like, that's your signature. And take a photo, and, like, that's how we'll follow along." And so, lo and behold, to this day, I can do a handstand and walk on my hands and Colosseum of Rome, the Pyramids of Giza. Actually, this last weekend, I did one on the Continental Divide, the Equator, you name it. I will do handstands wherever I go. Now, that costs nothing, and it doesn't take up any room in my travel bag. And keep in mind, I'm traveling on my own, so who's the one person who can't take that photo? Me. I have to find somebody, often where I'm not speaking the language, convince them that what I really want to do is stand on my hands in front of them and could they please take a photo. So of course they think I'm just, what? And then I do it, and then immediately, particularly children, rush. They start tumbling, they start doing handstands, you name it. It's become a real icebreaker. It's probably my calling card at this point. And I have hundreds now of photos doing handstands around the world. For me, it's not about the handstands as much as it is. It's a vehicle that carries a much bigger, not just message, but way to meet people and way to kind of engage more directly in my travels, especially with technology as we just kind of go around with our screens. It's back to that human connection. So that would be mine. Figure out what your party trick is.
So besides saying a camera, because I think that's just this crucial, besides your phone, I feel like people throughout the world actually take nicer when you actually have a big camera you want to take a photo of someone than a phone. But regardless of that, a flashlight. You don't know how crucial that is when you are, like, stuck in the middle of Iran. There's no street lights. Your phone is dead. Your camera is dead. And you have to find your way to the house you're supposed to be staying at in an ancient village that has no signs, nothing. So I have a map. You've just got your flashlight. So it's a very simple thing. It's very small. Just get one of those tiny ones. But that is something I always take with me.
There will come a time when reading glasses may surpass the flashlight.
And I was like, wait, Ziploc bags, Ziplocs.
This is kind of a series of related questions that I'm getting on cars and online, and I'm going to kind of lump them together. I'm going to take one out because it has to do with your favorite places, your favorite country. A senior traveler who has been all around the world, where should I go before I die, is sort of that central approach. One of them is least favorite country. My hunch is that none of you probably have necessarily a least favorite country. Maybe you do. But I think that the question that keeps cropping up is, where do you want to go? What has inspired you? What has been your favorite place? No, thank you. I apologize. What is your favorite place? Where did you connect? What was a special moment? Connor, I'm going to start back with you.
That is the hardest question to ask a traveler.
Yes, it is.
You know, I honestly love the Middle East, and I think it's because, specifically, I'd say Iran and Iraq. I was there 2 years ago, and I honestly think it's just because of the complete flip of how you see it in the media, like as I was talking earlier, to how it actually is. And I think a lot of my favorite memories from traveling, it's not the places you see, it's not those landmarks or the gorgeous views, it's the people that you interact with and the friends that you make. I mean, I've still probably everyone I stayed with in Iran and Iraq, I still talk to them to this day. So I'd say in terms of hospitality, just the, especially Iran, the richest in culture, kind of the battle between, when you, I'm not sure to say good and evil here, but you have a lot of pre-revolution sentiment coupled with the traditional values of Islam, and everyone's trying to work out a compromise, however difficult that could be. But that was probably just one of my favorite experiences, and I think, and I'm not sure if the American passport gets you to Iran these days, but I was fortunate enough to be able to go there through my Irish one. So I think in terms of just reach, limits, and the people, that's probably my favorite place so far.
Nice.
This is so hard, and I'm not going to give one. I just can't answer one. I get this question fairly often, and for me, I typically start like what's most important to you? What favorite country for what? For the topography, for the food, for, you know, and again, there are multiple answers to all of them.
For handstands.
They're all good. Yeah, there's always, and it, what's funny is I'm always like, local landmark, what is it? And even if it's a town where there aren't that many local, you know, there's no majestic backdrop, you can still find that local landmark. And people who have been there or are from there, I mean, water towers. I did one in a fountain one time, and I actually fell in the fountain. I did one in the, this was great, it, London, fair enough, it's London. But in the London Eye, in a London capsule, all the way at the top, and they took a photo of me doing a handstand in this capsule with, you could see Westminster Abbey. That was cool, right? No, but going, favorite countries. I could go to India until forever, and it's some of the most extraordinary travel, some of the most diverse travel. India is made up of 20 different states. No two have the same food. No two have the same exact culture. India gets under your skin. It's some of the most astounding, sensory, engaging travel, and it's also some of the hardest travel that you will ever take. Because, you know, I was looking at poverty alleviation. There's poverty, and then there's poverty with a capital P and, you know, neon colors. And India will stretch you in all senses. Over the years, I've had family in Italy, even before it became popular. All of Italy I find interesting. But again, it's 25 regions. Go to all, like, I've been to all 25. They're very different from one another. Places you can continue to go back again and again. I'll just mention Bolivia, even though I got held up at gunpoint, favorite country. Chile's there's so, you could travel in Chile. It's this long, skinny strip that has so much diversity packed into it. You begin with penguins and you end up in the desert. In one, that's just wow. I'll just put a little bit of a plug in. I'm really interested these days also in going places simply because other people aren't. So at the moment, one of my favorite places is Moldova. Now, what's in Moldova? Why was I attracted to go to Moldova? It has, so you can probably correct me on this. Florence, Italy gets 10 million visitors a year.
I think that's just on a Saturday.
Yeah, so 10 million a year, exactly. I should also put in a plug. You were Fulbright?
Yes.
Yeah, I was Fulbright, too. Apply for Fulbrights. I had a Fulbright in Italy. It was fabulous. 10 million a year. Sorry, 10 million a year, yeah, for in a weekend. 10 million in a weekend in Florence, Italy. Moldova gets 10,000 visitors a year, period. 10,000 a year. I was like, I want to go there. It turns out they have a wine region there. They have lots of history. Think about it like Albania or Hungary. I mean, this was on the front lines of the Cold War. They've struggled. They're hungry in terms of entrepreneurialism. The hospitality isn't what you'll find in a more touristed area in that region. So I really actively encourage you to seek out those places that it's getting harder and harder to find places that are truly off the beaten path. There are some. And that's what attracts me most. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah, the world's worst question if you travel. I'll answer it this way, that there's so many places that are beautiful, but if you don't like the people you're with or what you're doing, you know. And if you're psychologically carrying too much baggage, no matter where you go, it's going to suck. So figuring out how to release some of that before you go and making that place you get to the place and sort of bringing yourself to it. But the one moment that I will share that I always reflect on for that sense of, you know, the moment was in 2008 in Lebanon. Happened to be November 4th, and I'm going to play to the audience a little bit in saying that I had to stay up and watch the numbers. I wanted to see that the candidate of choice had crossed over to 270, and I was in Beirut, and it was late, and I'm sitting in the empty kitchen because it was the only television that had CNN, and you know, with a group of guys who didn't really understand, but they understood my enthusiasm, so I taught them all to yell 270, 270. And the next morning, got up very early, and it was up against the Syrian border, a small village, and we're having a meeting, and everyone is kind of standing around. There's a Sunni region, and guys, you know, wearing wool, and it's cold, and we're kind of shuffling the feet, and nothing's happening in them. It's a little one of those moments where your radar is kind of like, there's something, you know, what's really going on? And finally, the village chairman, he looks at me, and this is after spending many years living and working in the Middle East, and he looks at me, and he says, Obama. And I'm still so excited from the night before. I was like, yes, thumbs up, you know? And then he was like, how did you do it? America is a racist country, and you elected a black Muslim. And I will say I can't deny my sort of, you know, the way I pronounce things, the way I look, where I'm from, who I am. At that moment, I was so proud. That's the moment that comes back. Would I return certain places? For sure, that's one of them.
Yeah. I've got two questions here. I definitely would like to try and get to. One of them is sort of a very factual, pragmatic one, and I think it has to do with enthusiasm by students connecting with an NGO, and how, when you're evaluating what you're seeing online, when you're evaluating applications, any tips that the three of you have for getting a sense of legitimacy and finding a fit that would truly help the community that you're going to be visiting.
I think you should probably take that one.
Happy to comment, and actually, I'm going to just follow on to yours. So when you were in Lebanon, I was in Kenya when Obama was... No, and I share this because I had voted early and didn't know how it was going to play out, but I was working. I was doing microfinance and water and sanitation with local NGOs, and happened to be out in western Kenya. And I have never seen a ticker tape parade like I saw for Obama at that time. And I share that because I couldn't have scripted that. Even if I'd bought a ticket in advance, couldn't have planned that. And to be there during the... And I can only imagine being in Prague in 1990. Like, there are points in time for certain places that will maybe never be repeated, but you can, and don't overplan, but like those end up being the favorite, not because of anything that we did. I got to go visit Obama's grandmother, who at that point still had this little hut, sign her guest book, you know, And now it was just a different era, but we're living in an era now where we're having, you know, these kinds of experiences are happening. It's just a matter of kind of doing a little bit of triage and having a bit of luck. So back to the NGOs. This is interesting because so when I was traveling, when I was guiding, so I had a job, a role, earning income. But in the 6 months or ish that I was not traveling, that I was not working but traveling, I did volunteer in local nonprofits. And I'll be really candid. There was no application. This was, I am in Cusco, Peru. I am in Jodhpur, India. I'm going to ask my host if they know somebody, kind of, you know, these were short-term things, but whether it's teaching in English always, more and more these days, anything online. I am not a tech expert by any means, but I have helped update and improve websites because my tech skills are, they're better than what you might find locally. And so I was simply like, where can I help? So once I was on site, just kind of go for it. Now, I understand if you're a student, this is where, so I can't comment on all NGOs. For instance, like I worked a lot in microfinance. Microfinance is full of NGOs. I actually learned about the concept of microfinance during my travels. Before I knew what it was called, I was really interested in local economic development and how people, in particular women, were meeting their needs. I backed into this. An organization like Kiva.org, they have all kinds of microfinance partners. They have already vetted them. You can find them there. There's also I want to say it's BridgeStar, but that's not it. There is, I can't follow up on this. I think there are organizations that vet NGOs internationally, and do a kind of ranking. I want to say it's BridgeStar, but it's been a few years since I was directly focused on that. I would also highly encourage you, you know, if you're thinking about a particular location, is there anybody that you know or anybody here at the university that would know more? Where if you're not getting the answer, but you're getting one step closer to doing your due diligence. And also, of course, I personally, particularly if you're an undergrad, particularly if you're looking at getting some stepping stones, I don't want to be saying go out there and just do willy-nilly. Just contribute. I worry as you get more seasoned in your career, you're looking much more at which organizations are doing things, and you know, partnerships with corporations and that sort of thing. But if you're traveling and simply want to contribute, ask locals. And I wasn't too picky, because it wasn't too long term and it worked out. It actually there was not a single case in which I regretted having spent my time in that way.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of pay-to-play schemes out there, and I'd say scheme consciously. These are programs that are making money off of churning students coming through. Be very cautious. If you research and the website suggests that, you know, you're going to be one of 100 that week, probably not going to be a unique experience. Voluntourism is the broad topical area that this falls under. There are some good adventure programs that will talk to voluntourism. There are some ranches, game ranches in Africa and elsewhere, and you know, you spend two-thirds of the day in the barn shoveling, the proverbial shebop, and then you get to pet the animals and take pictures, and that's the voluntourism experience. There are a lot of game ranches that I know of that love their volunteers, and they charge them for that, and they think it's the, you know, it's heydays. So be careful. I'm not a particular fan of those voluntourism programs that are selling exclusively voluntourism. I think you've got a better option of having a positive experience if you're working and looking and researching an NGO that is doing something very specific to which they're expert at. And in the context of what it is that they do expertly, they need some assistance. And if it's a real position, but they're kind of going to leave it to you to find the lodging, if they're going to leave it to you to sort out some of the other aspects, but they're really interested in you being with them for their mission, that's probably going to be a better experience. That's easy to say unless you have to go back and talk to mom and dad. And if, you know, they're the ones that are helping to finance, sometimes they want to see, you know, more of a program around things, things that look a little bit more packaged. There's a borderline between desiring to be overseas and doing good and wanting to have that adventure. And I think you have to be honest with yourselves in assessing, if I want to go contribute, what exactly are your skill sets at 19 or 21 or even 45 that you can contribute in a meaningful way on your 7 or 14-day holiday? And, you know, it's not an easy equation, because most of the manual labor you might go paint, well, there's a lot of locals who can handle that, and they'll do it for far less than the cost that you spent on that plane ticket, which is why I fall back on that language suggestion. If you're going to be there anywhere for a longer period of time, you know, there's a lot of ways to travel that are for other purposes. There are a lot of churches and you know, folks that are traveling on mission that are going as a group, but the purpose is not exactly to rebuild that school or to help build that home. It's much more to share in the faith, and that's a very important part of a decision to go. If you're going to be honest and say, shucks, I only have 2 weeks, I'd like to do something, but you know what, make it an adventure and then figure out how to support through your travel choices and who you stay with and where you in what you eat and where you decide to take your activities, instead of trying to go with this ulterior motive of I'm going to give back, I'm going to go do something good. Because at the end of the day, you're just in a two-week horizon, you're probably not going to have a whole lot that's going to be so meaningful. That's a little bit raw, and I might be offending some folks in the room for whom, you know, this is something they do, and they do a lot, and I don't intend that to be the case. But I think there's a series of questions that you have to ask ahead of a decision, if that's the driver, and then to be honest and say, actually, it's really about me having an adventure, and that might shift your decision-making.
That's a nice segue to a series of questions that all kind of dance around the same basic issue, and we're running short on time, so I'm not gonna belabor it too much. But I'd like all of you to see if you could to comment on the inherent tension between the benefits of international travel and seeing the world with the socioeconomic advantages or disadvantages that enable some people to do that and some people not to be able to do that, and then again with the environmental consequences of jumping on an airplane for a 7-day trip and flying all the way to India to experience a festival outside of a town and then coming home. And how do you, I mean, that could be a 2 or 3 hour dissertation by all of you, I suspect, on that. But Connor, I'm going to start with you. What's just sort of a few bullet points that come to mind to help kind of reconcile those seemingly difficult concepts?
Yeah, you know, I think in terms of, I was actually speaking about this earlier in a different panel, but all of us up here have been very privileged to travel the world, and you know, we all come from, I would assume, middle-class families that have maybe not even financially supported us, but given us the avenues to education, to you know, studying an atlas at the table for breakfast, etc. But I think to not take advantage of that position and see the world and try to make it a better place and do the impact that you want to achieve would be a disservice to, I guess, the luck of the position you came into. And I would kind of build off of the last question as well of how do you kind of find a legitimate NGO. I wouldn't even limit yourself to an NGO. I would, if you find a company that you think is doing good with the world, and in the corporate world that's hard these days, but if you really find that passion, they can leverage your skills and your desire to travel, and you can live in a different country and basically live and breathe the impact you're making there. You can actually become a part of a new community. You can start reaching out to organizations. I'll be moving to Japan on Monday, and I'll be there for at least a year or 2 years. So that's like a real chance for me to get involved, to live and breathe like Japanese culture, where if I went there for 2 weeks and I wanted to make an impact, I probably wouldn't make any impact on the culture there. And I wouldn't even learn from it, to be honest. I would see a few landmarks and maybe experience the food. But to live and breathe with the people, I think, is probably the number one point I would make. And you know, and April, and you know, she's traveled extensively for, I would say, shorter periods of time working in these countries, but the opportunity to actually live and work, I think you're just making yourself a part of the facet of life. You're not an external person anymore. You are internal. You are trying to assimilate into a different culture. And I think that helps the longevity, number one, the exchange of belief systems and cultures that are mutually beneficial, in my opinion, and then just the long-lasting impact that you can have on yourself and changing your viewpoint of the world.
We have 2 minutes left.
Okay, I'll try. I want to echo everything that Connor said, and also going back to what Keith said earlier, and I know it is a bit raw, but he's bang on right. And when I, like, did I ever pay to volunteer? Are you kidding? No. I was not, this was not something, some kind of glorified, and I think with Instagram and all the rest, it's even more so. This is about sort of walking the talk and contributing where you can add value, but I was in large part already in these places. So this wasn't a trip to and from, it was more of what Connor is describing, and I wasn't staying for a year, but I mean, you're going to hear me say a couple things I already mentioned before, like jabbatical, which I described earlier, is exactly this. If I were to go do what I did back then today, I can guarantee you I would stay probably a minimum of a year in different places. But for me now, considering the time frame of 5 or 10 years of doing that, yeah, that sounds amazing. So I was on my phone because I was trying to pull up. I wrote a piece recently. I don't work in travel and tourism, but I wrote a piece recently about how we need a shift from thinking of ourselves as consumers of travel to really being destination stewards. So taking a much more proactive role in how we're traveling, but also what we're doing when we're there. And I'm going to echo mostly what Connor said. Stay long. Question really hard whether you actually need to go. And that's not anti-travel, but think about sustainable ecosystems, as we heard in the keynote yesterday. Stay longer. Stay in the same place longer. Contribute while you're there. Become part of the community as opposed to a sort of, pardon my speech, like voyeuristic, okay, look, you know, here we go. We've been there, done that, we're gone. There are also other initiatives such as the Good Traveler, which is an organization working with airlines. You're doing carbon offset, but then they're taking that money to fund. Carbon offset is like window dressing. What we really need are zero emissions aviation fuels. So they're investing that back into much more of a circular economy ecosystem. So there are various things out there, and I'm happy to share that link with anyone who wants it.
Keith, a final thought in that refrain?
Travel is an agent of change. Go forth. Be a change agent. You know, question going to Disney World, but don't ever question the value of your travel experience to a developing nation and the exchange and what can take place there.
Yeah. Fabulous. Thank you.